hundreds of thousands of people from Kolkata replied that I am from Kolkata and I can relate to it. It's getting murdered in front of my eyes.
I am trying to rebuild a civilization. I'm not building just an economy.
Yeah.
So building a highway and rebuilding the Ayodhya temple are a part of the same agenda.
Why did people elect Jyoti Basu for the socialist government?
People elect all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
Question is, why did they re-elect him? My view is, why shouldn't Indians be billionaires? We are one-sixth of the world's population. One-sixth of the world's billionaires should live in India.
I was recently in US, in Los Angeles. There's a summit called Montgomery Summit, held by Montgomery family, which is a billionaire family. So every slide had India at its forefront.
Absolutely. So that is a change. We could have done this a generation ago, maybe two generations ago. But we didn't. Because our aspiration was ki hum gareeb rahenge. If you must dream, surely you should dream to be Elon Musk or Mukesh Ambani. Why did you dream to be Joint Secretary?
Yeah, are you not dreaming to be Sachin and Bini Bansals of Flipkart?
I still think way too many young kids who have so much energy, etc., are wasting their time basically trying to crack the UPSC.
Yes.
If they put the same energy into doing something else, we would be winning more Olympic gold medals. We'd be seeing better movies being made. We'd see better doctors, entrepreneurs, scientists, and so on. So I would say it's a waste of time.
This is Siddharth Ahluwalia. Welcome to the Neon Show. Sanjeev Sanyal, sir, so good to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Your first episode on Neon Show received tremendous response. Almost at 800,000 views on the main episode. Few shorts have crossed 1 million each. And the audience wanted back you on the show. Thank you so much for coming back. I'm so glad that we could make it happen.
It's a pleasure.
So would like to start with, what are the different things that you're now part of, right? It's been almost 4-5 months since our last conversation.
So, I mean, obviously my day job, which is my primary activity, is running the economy.
Yeah.
So, I'm an economic advisor to the Prime Minister. And so that takes up much of my time. I also have an interest in writing history books, as you know. So, although I've not written a book recently, but I do give lectures and so on. And one of those books, Revolutionaries, is being converted into an Amazon Prime series. So, that is something on the side. I'm also trying to build, by the way, a wooden ship.
Okay.
Based on a 5th century AD design, which is a Gupta era design, of a ship from the Indian Ocean region. And it will be built on the original concept. So there will be no nails in it. It will be stitched together. And it will have, obviously, all the sails. And it will not even have a rudder. It will be using a trailing oar. Okay. And the idea is to build this, which is being done in Goa as we speak. And the next year when it comes on stream, then with the help of the Navy, I'm going to attempt to sail this first to Oman and then to Indonesia.
Amazing. We'll look forward to it. So our audience loved our conversation about Kolkata last time. And they're all asking more details on it. Like last time you mentioned the word Kolkata didn't die. It was murdered.
Hmm.
And our audience just latched onto it because hundreds of thousands of people from Kolkata replied, shared on comments that I am from Kolkata or I have visited Kolkata, stayed in Kolkata for 20 years and I can relate to it. It's getting murdered in front of my eyes, right? So just want to go back to the history of it, where it all started with maybe Chief Minister Jyoti Basu. Yeah. And in 1947, as you mentioned in a few interviews, it was the largest hub, the largest city across Asia, like after Japan, maybe.
So, when I was born, as I mentioned, Kolkata was, even in 1970, it was India's biggest city. It was the biggest commercial and industrial hub. It was culturally, politically a very vibrant place. Indeed, before independence, it was even more important because it, of course, was a capital till 1912. Actually, effectively into the 1930s, because even though the capital shifted, it continued to be the main hub. And it produced all these greats within a few generations. I mean, Vivekanand, Sri Aurobindo, Netaji,
Rabindranath
Tagore. And by the way, many of these people knew each other very well. So it's within a couple of generations and this huge, and by the way, there were huge industries. Bengalis, by the way, were famous as scientists, as businessmen.
The original Marwadi.
Success came from Kolkata, not from their original homeland in Rajasthan. So the Birlas originally made their money there. So this was a real driver. And then it all fell apart. And this is important to understand because when one thing falls apart, which is, let's say you decide that, you know, you're going to, for whatever socialist kind of reasons, you're going to wreck the economy, be very clear that everything else gets wrecked as well. So there is no such thing as a vibrant cultural hub, which is not also an economic hub. So this is important, because this is also in the context, you know, many people ask me, why do you do work in so many areas? Why are you working in history? Why are you building this ship? Why are you also working on the, why don't you just focus on this?
Yeah.
They have completely misunderstood what we are trying to do. In the end, I'm trying to rebuild a civilization. I'm not building just an economy. The economy is a part of it, but the overall purpose is rebuilding the civilization. So building a highway and rebuilding the Ayodhya temple are a part of the same agenda. And they cannot be understood separately from each other. And by the way, all civilizations that go through a renaissance or a rebirth have this phenomena.
The Europe, for example, you talked about it.
Yes. Yeah. So if you look at the late 1300s, 1400s, what happens in Europe? In northern Italy, not even in all of Europe. In small area, northern Italy, a whole small group of relatively small towns go through this explosion. And you have Florence, for example, producing this amazing art. Venice produces this amazing art. But in fact, neither of those is actually, their real business is not art. It's actually, in the case of Florence, it's finance, right? They're banking. What is their great invention? It is not art. It is actually double entry bookkeeping. Venice's great success are maritime trade. It's the stock exchange. And so all the art is actually a sub thing that sort of happens on the side as a result of this.
When you have wealth, these things are the side
effect. That is precisely what I'm trying to tell you. That is the wrong way to think about it. What really is happening is an opening of mind, an opening of aspiration, which is manifesting in different ways. So the same people who were funding the art were also doing the banking and also sailing the shores. And by the way, this entire phenomenon that I just mentioned starts from northern Italy, rapidly spreads. It goes to it goes to the Netherlands, it goes to the Britain, it goes to Spain. So the same people who are listening to Shakespeare write his plays and his first actual Shakespearean plays done for the first time, the Elizabethan England, are also the people who sank the Armada. It's Francis Drake must have watched those Shakespearean plays. He also is the guy who goes and circumnavigates the world. It's the same people who set up the first East India Company. Same thing is going on, meanwhile, in the Netherlands. So what I'm trying to say is, it is not surprising that Kolkata was the hub of everything, because it very often were the same people doing all these different things. They knew each other. So it's really a opening of mind that happened. And it's called the Bengal Renaissance, in the same way as you talk about the European Renaissance. So when it went into decline, it was a closing of mind. And the closing of mind didn't just happen in business and in commerce. It also happened in science. At about the same time, it happened in culture. It happened in every sphere of human activity. So it is extraordinary that not only did, you know, the Birlas and all these people leave Kolkata and set up shop in Mumbai and other places, it is also the case that Kolkata has never produced again somebody of the caliber of Satyajit Ray or Rabindranath Tagore or Swami Vivekanand or Netaji Subhash Bose or Sri Aurobindo or Acharya Jagadish Chandra Bose or any number of other names I can give you. It just didn't produce anybody of that caliber. Once things began to unwind, everything unwound.
And what caused, like why did people elect Jyoti Basu or the socialist government in the first place?
So, you know, people elect all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
The question is, why did they re-elect him?
Yes.
Because having elected him, it was quite obvious what he was doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Even I remember in his first term, which was, I think, 77 to whatever, 82 or whatever, the first term whenever he got elected, he already had carried out the Mauri Japi massacre.
Yeah.
He had already begun to shut down businesses.
Yeah.
He already was mismanaging electricity supply so that, you know, I remember growing up doing my homework essentially by lantern and candlelight. You know, people have this thing ki mere pitaji bahut gareeb the, and then he would sit under a, you know, would do his homework by kerosene lamp and all that. I also did my homework by kerosene lamp. Not because I came from a poor family. I came from a solidly middle-class family. But because there was no electricity. And this was before the days of when generators were commonly available. So, it was a... The question is, why did they keep getting him back despite lack of performance?
Yeah.
You know, you can try out anybody once. Why do you keep... Now, some part of it was, of course, electoral malpractice. Booth capturing was converted into a art form. But I would argue that even more important than that was a poverty of aspiration. If your society aspires that the highest form of life is a union leader or a, you know, an Adda intellectual, what in Kolkata is called an Atel, and, you know, that is your aspiration, that you are sitting around smoking and having, sipping your old monk and, you know, passing judgment on the rest of the world rather than doing anything.
And smoking throughout the day.
You can smoke. I personally have no problem with either of them, your health. But point of the matter, that is the aspiration of the society. If Mrinal Sen movies are the aspiration of your society, then do not complain that that is what you get.
And suddenly, from being the aspiration of society to being a scientist, right? By electing, and you mentioned it's a complex world. Once you elect the wrong kind of government, you set wrong kind of aspirations. And it's
no,
a...
it's the other way around. That's the point I'm making to you repeatedly. So the first... It is not the government that causes this problem.
It is a poverty of aspiration.
It is a poverty of aspiration that leads you to these governments. Ultimately, every people get the leader they deserve.
And where
if you deserve, if you want to elect, you know, a Lalu Yadav, then you do not expect anything else as the outcome.
And where do people get this poverty of aspiration?
So this is a huge debate, a sociological debate. Other people can work on it. But it happens to every people at certain points in time. Some cycles are short, some are long. But if you look at, say, the West, right? There was a time, whether you like it or not, they did conquer the whole world. Okay. Brutal as it may have been, it is also quite extraordinary that, you know, a small country like Britain ruled over us.
70% of the world.
Yeah, and you had even more tiny country, Netherlands, controlled Indonesia and South Africa and all kinds of other places, Sri Lanka. So you have to grant it to these guys that they were willing to take these things, these huge risks, and they had this sort of scale of thought. It is the Europeans did create much of modern society, the scientific breakthroughs and so on. And the same thing happened with America in much of the 20th century. They aspired to go to the moon. They aspired to create all the technologies that we today create. Then at some point in time, their aspiration shrank to which gender they wanted to have. And so I can assure you that the politics you are now seeing in America is a direct reflection of the poverty of their aspirations.
And I can completely now relate and understand what you are trying to say. First, people choose their heroes and then they create their societies.
Yes, absolutely. You ultimately become the heroes that you choose. So, if your heroes are, you know...
Union leaders.
Union leaders, then you'll get union leaders. If your you know, great economists are basically glorifying poverty, then don't complain that you get poverty. But because in each one of these things, an economy arises out of it. You know, so you will get an entire povertarian system will emerge out of it. You'll get NGOs that will fund research that talks about certain kinds of poverty. Uske liye paisa aayega. Then that money will be utilized. Now, supposing it begins to actually solve poverty, that's a problem. Because your business model is based on perpetuating poverty.
It's like, I remember there was a theory that Englishmen used to pay snake holders or people who used to catch snake. So now people started breeding snakes.
Yes. And so I'll give you one example on which I have written myself very recently. A newspaper article appeared recently in a leading newspaper in India. And then it was carried in similar kind of ways in others as well. That many millions of kids in India are zero food kids, okay, zero food infants. So they're babies, basically 6 to 12 months old, 6 to 24 months or whatever, they were called zero food infants. Okay, and there are so many millions of them. And then there was this thing was based on a study that was published, which also mentions, you know, zero food. So I wonder, look, if there's so many millions of kids who are getting zero food, then they shouldn't be alive even. Yeah. So how are they even alive? Yeah. So I dug into this. And by the way, I've written this as an article in Swarajya, so other people who want to read it can. So what I discovered, that it wasn't actually zero food. What was going on? So there were these babies who, in the 24 hours before the survey was taken, had not been fed anything other than breast milk.
Okay.
Now, breast milk is food. In fact, we have a huge campaign in India to encourage mothers to breastfeed their kids. Okay, now supposing a child who's 7 months old, mostly is fed on breast milk, but for the previous 24 hours has not been fed whatever, porridge or something, then according to this survey, he or she would be a zero food baby. Now, of course, there are millions of such babies in this country. Right? Is it a bad thing? No. In fact, we encourage mothers to breastfeed their babies. And yet, this was being set up in a way that was suggesting that there is mass starvation of babies in the country, which is absolutely not the case. I mean, there may be nutritional problems, but mass starvation is not the problem. And yet, you were setting this up. So I looked into this whole thing. So this whole thing is a well-oiled machine. One of these billionaire foundations will go and fund these studies. Then those studies will show if either nutrition, vitamin D deficiency, whatever it is, the latest thing that you want to sell to India. And then it will be then, next stage will be, it will come out even more sensationalized in the press. So what will happen is that public perception will be built up for a certain povertarian narrative. And then that pressure will be used to carry out certain policy interventions, which, you know, are useful to whoever was the original funder of the project. And so you'll be sold medicines, you'll be sold baby food, you'll be sold all kinds of things. And by the way, this is a very long history to this. This is not a new phenomena. This has been going on at least from independence.
And we know that all the baby food companies are American companies.
Yeah, but you know, I can tell you that this thing is a very old thing. And there are many well-known phenomena in India, which have its origins in this ecosystem of research funded by these foreign agencies. And then certain outcomes, which are then, interestingly, those outcomes are then criticized by the same funding agencies for other purposes. And I'll give you one example, which is fully documented. So I want you to know this because it is a fully documented thing. We all know that even now, but till very recently, we had a serious problem with gender selective abortion. Huh? And because of which, particularly in some of these northwestern states, there was a serious imbalance in the number of boys being born, much in excess of the number of girls, right?
Yeah.
You all know this. And India has been much criticized for this.
Haryana has been.
Haryana, particularly Punjab, Western UP. This is basically the zone where this happens. And basically we are told this is because of, our inborn cultural patriarchy, evil Indian customs, etc. Now, let me tell you the actual origin of this. Back in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, there were a series of articles in Western journals talking about how non-white populations were growing very fast and then they would overwhelm the world. So it was purely, quite offensively racist. They didn't realize we would read them today, but they are quite blatant about the fact that their main problem is that non-white populations are growing very fast. So it was decided by various departments of that time, geopolitical powers of that time, that there something had to be done about this. Because otherwise the world would be taken over by these brown and looking people. So a huge effort was done. Let us intervene in these countries to have population control. So how were they going to do this? So they decided that, look, the number of men does not actually matter. It is the number of women that matters. because they are the, you can have only one man and you can still have population growth if
and number of women
are there. So therefore, we need to do something about reducing the number of girls being born. So here came the thought that what you can do is to weaponize son preference in traditional societies. Now, all traditional societies have son preference. Now, nothing new. Even the West, before they developed, had a preference for sons, which is, you know, they are needed for work, they are needed for war, and so on. So there is a son preference. But it's quite different from what happened next. So basically, they came to India and they sold this idea to the Indian authorities in the late 60s and 70s. Of course, in the emergency, had Nasbandi, etc. But the thing in which they really focused was something quite different. They basically, these whole bunch of these Rockefeller, Ford, even some UN agencies were involved in this, and they basically imported with their funding ultrasound machines. And they basically said that, look, this is great. Why don't you allow parents to actually choose their child? So now you're weaponizing a son preference. And they know why they are doing this. Yeah. Then the first several thousand of these sex selection abortions happened in AIMS. The doctors who carried out those operations with full support from these international agencies, they are still alive. And this is all well documented. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, they began to spread this message. So they began to these so-called, these NGOs, got into their cars. In those days, SUVs were quite rare. So they were the only people who used to have these large SUVs, and they're white colored SUVs from Lodhi Road. They drove out in different directions. And if you then look at where the gender imbalances were the worst after that, in the 80s, 90s and so on,
because they would go
it
north.
Was in those along those highways leading out of Lodhi Road. Now, all of this is very well documented. There's a book called Unnatural Selection by a Pulitzer winning journalist called Mara Wiesenthal. You can get her book on Amazon. All of this is well documented, that this whole sex selection operation was funded by these agencies in India. These ultrasounds were brought in. The doctors were trained. The operations actually happened in AIMS. And when it began to cause this imbalance in birth, who was blamed? Indian culture. Okay. And then the same agencies now have entire departments telling us how, you know, we should have better XYZ for women. So what did they manage to do? They were, first of all, manipulating our population. They were creating a market for their ultrasound machines. Huh? So the same thing happens when you hear, you know, there is a huge problem with vitamin D deficiency, this and that. Always be very suspicious about where these studies are being conducted, because essentially what is happening, you are being manipulated. And going back to our earlier point, your aspirations are also being manipulated.
And so we really don't know, right, where this poverty of aspiration. It can be a theory. It might have come from the West.
No. So some part of it is, of course. I mean, you are told that you should not aspire to have billionaires, right? You're told, oh my God, look, you have such poverty, you should not have billionaires. Adani, Ambani. Not today, Adani, Ambani. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was growing up, we used to hear Tata Birla, right? But my view is, why shouldn't Indians be billionaires? We are 1/6 of the world's population. 1/6 of the world's billionaires should live in India, right? After all the NGOs that scream so much about this billionaire problem, all of them are actually funded by Western billionaires. Soros's Open Society, Omidyar, Ford, Rockefeller, kaun hai? Ye sab billionaire hai. The problem is not with Gora billionaires. If the billionaires is white, it's perfectly fine. It's with brown billionaires they have a problem. Why do they have a problem with brown billionaires?
I can give you one example, right, which is closer to the venture capital world. The Omidyar established the Omidyar Fund back like 15 years ago to fund the poor population of India. Recently, they closed the fund in India and went back. And they had huge, like 50 to 100 employees for a fund that's large. And the reason was that India doesn't need us. it's not that India doesn't need us. India has stopped listening to their narrative.
Absolutely. We have stopped listening to their narrative. They were trying to manipulate us and they were called out. That is all there is to it. And the same thing is happening. So going back to this point of zero food, please go and look at who funded it. That paper tells you who funded it. And they are the same people who fund similar studies and other things. And so it is shocking that this not only is the problem of poverty of aspiration, very often this poverty of aspiration is slowly seeped into you. A certain, through movies, yeah, you look at the kinds of movies of India, Indian movies, that will be given awards, wahi povertarian wale.
Yeah.
Aap garibi bolenge, toh aapko Nobel Prize bhi milega. Aap garibi bolenge, toh, this is basically fed back into you, that we should aspire for poverty.
Yeah. Like Mother India was such a called out movie, though it was a brilliant movie, but it received international honors back in its day, because it was called, like, it showed the poverty of India.
No, but at least in those days, we were that poor. Yeah. Today, we are nowhere near that poor. Yeah. And so this change that you're seeing in India is a lot to do with the changes that are happening in our own heads.
And the heroes we are choosing now.
Absolutely. So the changes in our own heads and the aspirations we have, we now say that we will build a better parliament. We will build the world's largest office complex. We will go to the moon. And at every stage, notice, these same people will come and tell you, "Are, why you are a poor country, why do you want to do this?" Yes, we want to do it. In fact, you know, the average auto driver who is very poor also feels a certain sense of pride that India is sending a satellite to the moon. Right? So why does he feel it? Because his aspirations have changed. And so if you look at India as a map, you will see, you can clearly see the difference of economic success is directly correlated to aspirational success.
So I'll tell you one incident. I was recently in US in Los Angeles. There's a summit called Montgomery Summit. And it's held by Montgomery family, which is a billionaire family. On every slide, the first slide was presented by the family, the 30 slide. So every slide had India at its forefront. They're saying them.
Absolutely. So that is a change. That is a change. We could have done this a generation ago, maybe two generations ago, but we didn't. Because our aspiration was ki hum gareeb rahenge.
And coming to a diatomy, right, which people call, we want to build the best temples in India, the largest, the magnificent temples. And the best government buildings now, and we are tearing up our old government buildings. Why is that?
It's the same logic. So if you see, go to Shastri Bhavan, then you'll understand the poverty of aspiration. These were built in the 50s. Now the government buildings of the previous generation, which the British had built, look at them, North Block and South Block, whatever it may be, they had genuine imperial ambitions and they expressed it, right? So you can disagree with their colonial policies and all that. But you cannot say that from their perspective, they were not ambitious and that, you know, they aspired to signal power and whatever it is that they were doing, they did. What did we aspire? We aspired for building these concrete, small concrete CPWD construction. Go to Shastri Bhavan or Nirman Bhavan or any number of other Bhavans in Delhi. And this is central government. Yeah. State government ke to chhodi dijiye. Yeah. From 1947 till the now very recent building of the new parliament, tell me one genuine, serious building that post-independence India built. None. Right? Wo ek Vidhan Sauda building banaya tha Bangalore mein, which is okay. It's a decent size building. But, you know, there'll be the very, very few really, you know, great buildings. It's only in recent times that we have begun to aspire to build big. So this is, and the aspiration we have. So the same thing, when we tear down these old government buildings, what is the aspiration we have? Ki wo narrow lanes honge, uske andar bureaucrats baithenge, air conditioner hoga, usme se dripping hoga, the whole, and then when you walk down those damp corridors, you'll be, you can smell the toilet from anywhere along. That is our aspiration. Right? So it's not that people at that time didn't know how to build better, because just a generation earlier they had built North Block and South Block. Huh? These are same people whose forefathers had built, the Meenakshi Temple and Taj Mahal, etc. So it's not like Indians didn't know how to construct good buildings. So why is it that we built Shastri Bhavan? So the tearing down of Shastri Bhavan is the tearing down of a block in our head. And it's an important thing to tear these buildings down. Because otherwise we will be caught in that. And not only will we be caught in that, we will be also encouraged to think that that is all we can aspire to. So this, and then when we have not succeeded, rather than blame this poverty aspiration, you'll blame other things. You know, even by the 70s, our economic growth was quite obviously floundering. But who was blamed? Did we blame Nehru or socialism? No, we blamed Hinduism, Hindu rate of growth.
And it's a very interesting thing, right? The West is criticizing India for building the statue of Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel. Wherein they're saying it's not economically efficient and you could have realized taxes better. But now we have Bill Gates coming in India and posing a video in front of Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, and now they're praising it.
No, no. The point of the matter is they want us to go to America, stand in front of Statue of Liberty and do a selfie.
Yeah.
If we do it in front of a building that we built, that is their problem. India mein bhi agar kar rahe ho, toh it is okay to do it in front of Victoria Terminus because they built it. If we built it, do it in front of something we built, then there is a problem.
And probably, I think it will take some time to get over brown billionaires.
No, I think it will happen faster than you think. After all, they quickly accepted Chinese and Japanese billionaires. They have no problem with Arab sheikhs. So they'll get used to Indian billionaires also. In fact, we need to get used to Indian billionaires. Our problem is not that Indian billionaires, but our problem is we don't have enough of them. I want more billionaires, new first generation billionaires. They will generate the jobs. They will generate the energy, and there should be continuous churn of them.
The thing is, then it's not just a problem of Bengal having the poverty of aspiration. Even Bihar and Kerala, both of these states have followed the same and ended up having the same set of leaders.
Yeah, I mean, Bihar, as I said, just like Bengal aspired to pseudo-intellectuals and union leaders, Bihar aspired to small-time local goon politicians.
Or UPSC,
yeah. So in an environment where those are the role models, you can either you can become a local goon. If you don't want to become a local goon, your way out is to basically become a civil servant. Now, even that, although it's better than being a goon, even that is a poverty of aspiration. I mean, at the end of it, why, you know, if you must dream, surely you should dream to be Elon Musk or Mukesh Ambani. Why did you dream to be joint secretary?
Yeah. Are you not dreaming to be Sachin and Vinny Bansals of Flipkart?
Yeah. So that's the point I'm making. So you need to, think about how a society thinks about risk-taking, and scale, and so on. So I think one of the problems of, say, a place like Bihar is not that it had bad leaders. The bad leaders are a reflection of what that society aspires for. So if you're aspiring for this, you will get it. So I think what is happening, thankfully, is across the country, our aspirations are changing. Now, of course, not everywhere. I still think way too many young kids who have so much energy, etc., are wasting their time basically trying to crack the UPSC.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you don't want people to take the exam. Yes, every country needs a bureaucracy. That's perfectly fine. But I think lakhs of people spending their best years trying to crack an exam where a tiny number of few thousand people are actually going to get in makes no sense. If they put the same energy into doing something else, you know, we would be winning more Olympic gold medals. We would be seeing better movies being made. We would see better doctors. We would see more, entrepreneurs, scientists and so on. So I would say that same energy put into something else. So I would say it's a waste of time. And I always discourage people unless they really want to be, you know, an administrator, they shouldn't take the UPSC exam. I mean, if they're real, because many of them, after having gone through it, then they get frustrated through the course of their career. In the end, you know, life in bureaucracy is not meant for everybody, and large parts of it, as with any profession, but large parts of it are largely dull and boring and about passing files up and down. And unless you really wanted to do it, and you're not going to be particularly happy with it.
I'll share one more anecdote with you right now. In India, it was unheard of that both husband-wife couples are entrepreneurs. That is now happening in hordes and hordes. So Indian society as a whole is giving up security as a notion. Why we claimed for UPSC or even 50,000 people lined up on a railway station for a few thousand police jobs, which has been recently, right, in Kanpur.
And this is still happening. But I'm trying to say it is changing. At least in the middle class, it has significantly changed. People are taking risks. And this is going back to my original point. This is an opening of mind which is not just happening in that little space of entrepreneurship. This is a change of attitude. And this change of attitude will manifest itself in everything. It will manifest itself in science. It will manifest itself in music, in literature. I mean, there's an explosion of Indian, Indian literature as well. All kinds of innovation will happen because we will naturally live in this world where doing new things and so on is thought of being as a natural thing that, you know, people do, and it is encouraged, as opposed to what happens even in Indian intellectual life. For example, one of the things that will strike you, true of Indian academia to this day, that when you go through a certain argument, the argument is not ultimately won by virtue of the logic from first principles or from the evidence you bring. Ultimately, the argument is won by quoting authority. Ki Gandhi ji ne kaha tha, or Ambedkar ne kaha tha, whoever happens to be your favorite great. Okay, that is a society that is not thinking in an expanding way. It has already decided that the ultimate has been said already by somebody, and that is the limits of knowledge.
And as you mentioned, right, our poverty of aspiration led us to cling on to Gandhi ji. Gandhi ne kaha vyapari bura hai. Profit bure.
Jo bhi hai. Point of the matter is that is essentially a society that is not progressing. It is already jammed up because you have already defined what is progress by some great, whoever happens to be your great.
And we have in the last 25 years case studies of cities like Mumbai, Bangalore, Hyderabad, obviously New Delhi, Gurgaon getting developed. But in the recent past itself, like Uttar Pradesh is changing its image dramatically.
Yes, so that's why. So sometimes you need to actually do an external shock, so to speak, to begin to change that dynamics. And I think you are seeing that in a place like Eastern UP. Western UP, theek hai, Noida, Waida, they have access to Delhi. They anyway were coming out of that. But I think what is happening now is very visible in Eastern UP. Started, of course, with Varanasi. But now with, if you look at Ayodhya, new airport, the kind, you know, a big new temple. And so the changing dynamics of that is quite, quite visible. The highways that are going through, the train stations. We are no longer thinking in small scale, you know, thinking in stuff that, you know, our great grandchildren will be proud to look at. That's how we think about it now. First time.
And Gujarat building is the first gift city of India.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say, at every level, we try to do something. Now, not all of this will succeed. Not all of this will be great. Some of it will be rubbish. It's okay. And some of it will be pulled down. But you see, we don't start with the thing ki hum log gareeb hain, to gareeb the, gareeb hain, aur yani kisi tarah se gareeb bhi rahenge. So that we have broken out of.
Yeah. And it's wonderful to see, right? Even the West is trying to pull India down. Let's say, for example, I don't know whether it's truth or false, Hindenburg published the report on Adani.
Look, there are people who will support India's rise, and there are people who will find that threatening. That is the nature of being. Yes. We have to allow for the fact that this, we are changing the dynamics of the world. There will be people who will benefit, and they will applaud, and there will be who will try to push us down. So, in the same country, there will be different groups and different things. So, if you go to the US, for example, there are people who will, you know, who are enthusiastic about India. They will be, want to invest in India. They want to help us. There are Indian diaspora who is very excited about it. And then there are others who will find it threatening. including members, by the way, of the Indian diaspora, who had created this entire ecosystem based on essentially milking India's poverty for whatever projects and so on. There'll be members of the old elite of India who are no longer find themselves relevant, whatever it may be. So it's not just that there will be members of our own who will feel threatened by this.
So thank you so much, sir. It's been a wonderful discussion. I think poverty of aspiration is such a highlighted topic that we need to educate our youth on that. Choose your heroes wisely if you choose your
absolutely
heroes, the best scientists.
The danger is that very often you will end up increasing like the heroes you choose.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, sir.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure hosting you second time on the Neon Show. Such an honor.